I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times.
So throughout history, Juneteenth has been known by many names. Jubilee Day, Freedom Day, Liberation Day, Emancipation Day, and today, a national holiday.
That was Vice President Harris yesterday at a ceremony at the White House where President Biden signed legislation making June 19th or Juneteenth a federal holiday to commemorate the end of slavery in the United States. Biden said signing this bill will go down as one of the greatest honors of his presidency, adding all Americans can feel the power of this day and learn from our history. Speaking in Tulsa earlier this spring to mark the 100th anniversary of the race massacre in that city, Biden said we should know the good, the bad, everything. That's what great nations do. They come to terms with their dark sides, and we're a great nation. Well, one way that nations grapple with their dark sides is through truth commissions or truth and reconciliation commissions, a public airing and acknowledgement of political violence. Today on Radio Times, is it time for a truth commission to address our legacy of slavery and racism? Let me introduce our two guests. And joining us by Skype is Dr. Charles Chavis. He's an assistant professor of conflict resolution and history at George Mason University, commissioner at the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and a member of the board of directors at the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project. Dr. Chavis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And also joining us is Dr. Kile Bohile Jrubgo. She's an assistant professor of government at William & Mary and founder and director of the International Justice Lab. And Dr. Jrubgo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let me begin with Juneteenth, and then we will move on from there to you, Dr. Chavis. What is the significance that now it is a federal holiday?
It's amazing. It is amazing to witness this. I had colleagues, we had meetings were getting canceled today at the university because we were just so honored to be living when this actually took place. We think it's so important and it's a long overdue, I think. But for many of us, it's what we see as a first step. Now that we have the attention of political leaders around the importance of this history and honoring this history, we want to use these opportunities as leverage to now begin to talk about policy change, which we'll lay out and discuss a little bit later on, I imagine.
I imagine we will, and I appreciate that. And to you, Dr. Jrubgo, I mean, now we've got this federal holiday. I think the question to the American people is, what is Juneteenth, and will they know the answer? Certainly a lot of Black people will know the answer to that, but will the rest of the population? Do we know our history?
As a scholar of transitional justice and of studying historical memory, I definitely think that we in the U.S. don't know enough about our history. And so it'll be on policymakers, on civic leaders to communicate the significance of this day, which is when the last enslaved were in Texas were told that they were indeed emancipated. And it's Liberation Day, like the Vice President said, Jubilee Day, all these different things. But it's the first step on the road to recognizing full humanity of African Americans and full citizenship of African Americans. So to second Charles, I think it's important that we start talking about policy steps that succeed this commemoration.
Well, let me pick up. And the reason you're here is we wanted to talk about truth commissions or truth and reconciliation commissions and the role that they can play in helping us understand our history, know our history, acknowledge it, you know, accept it. Let me put this first to you, Dr. Chavis, since you sit on some commissions. What is the role? What is the role of a truth commission?
Well, the role of the truth commission is first, as the title suggests, to promote narrative change and truth. For us in Maryland, our commission is the first commission in the country to focus specifically on confronting the legacy of racial terror lynchings throughout the state. And we're tasked with investigating over 44 cases, a number that continues to grow week by the week. And it's really a difficult task. There's really no blueprint in many ways domestically in the American sense in terms of a state level commission. But we see truth as our main focus. And we believe that white supremacy thrives off of the suppression of narrative, right? And a lot of the things that we're doing now really have to center on salvaging the humanity of these victims as well as their descendants, of which we are working with as we continue our work with the commission. We see that there's a direct line between the racial terror lynchings of old to the anti-Black violence that we continue to see on our screens today. I mean, some of the more recent cases have recently become popularized. Ahmaud Arbery has been added to the over 6,000 cases of racial terror lynchings in our country's history. And so we've got to make sure they understand that, yes, we're focusing on, you know, this dark part of our nation's history, but we also have to reckon with the fact that it is a part of a continuum, that Black communities and communities of color continue to deal with this trauma. And that part of the healing piece is for the country to acknowledge that trauma.
And I want to pick up on that. Let me go to you, Dr. Zhrubko. And people may not remember, even know, but back in 1980, Congress set up the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment on Civilians. This was about the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. This was something that was ordered by the president, President Roosevelt, at the time. So we have a history of dealing of using truth commissions.
Yes, we do. And I think just for the audience members, it might be helpful to provide a working definition of truth commissions. And so this is mine that I draw from Priscilla Hayner's seminal book, Unspeakable Truths. And so a truth commission is a temporary government-sponsored body that is tasked with investigating events in the past to investigate and establish a pattern of abuse, all while engaging with the affected population. And so that can mean survivors, non-surviving victims' families, and descendants in cases where abuse has happened quite a while back in the past. And it's part of this toolkit of transitional justice, which encompasses truth, justice, reparations, and guarantees of non-recurrence, or reforms, basically. And so in the U.S., we had the 1980 Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, the second National Truth Commission. The first was the Kerner Commission in 67 to investigate the race riots the year before and their antecedents. And so we have these great national models from several decades ago, not as much progress on national commissions encompassing broader issues since, but we have lots of state and city level truth commissions, including in Maryland ongoing, previously in Maine, ongoing in Alachua County in Florida. That's also to look at racial terror lynchings, just, you know, really all over the United States. And so it's encouraging to see this multiplication of efforts to acknowledge the truth. And just from my perspective, from my vantage point, I think we might be more likely to see action at a sub-national level than at a national level because of partisan gridlock.
Well, I wanted to ask about that, and perhaps I'll put this to you, Dr. Chavis, which is, do we live in a time when we can agree on what the truth is? And I ask that, of course, sort of knowing how split the country is on so many issues.
Well, the thing that really has informed and really colored my optimism about our ability, even at the national level, to establish a U.S. Truth Commission is really informed by my experience working as vice chair for the Maryland Lynching Commission. And just to give background to the audience, this commission was established bipartisan and unanimously through our state legislature. And we have a Republican governor who signed off on it. And so for us, that really informs our approach. And we're optimistic in many ways as it relates to how this work can be duplicated throughout the country. And so we really hope and support, actually, HCON Resolution 19, which Congresswoman Barbara Lee is promoting Again, it's calling for this U.S. National Truth, Racial Healing and Transformation Commission to be established. And the difference, I would argue, from this commission is that it really confronts our nation's original flaws, our original sins, if you will, of anti-blackness, racism, sexism, et cetera. I'll turn it over to the good doctor to discuss this a little more, specifically in terms of the difference in the frameworks and what makes the Truth Commission being proposed by Congresswoman Barbara Lee different from those elsewhere, and how, you know, in the United States, we need something that is uniquely designed to confront our unique issues regarding anti-blackness.
Well, let me frame that slightly differently, but ask a similar question to you, Dr. Zhrebko, which is, you know, we all witnessed on television the insurrection on January 6th, and yet Congress cannot come up with a commission to address what happened. And there are all sorts of wacky conspiracy theories about what allegedly happened, and I think we know what happened that day. But nonetheless, Congress can't seem to do that. What makes you think that we can get a U.S. Commission on Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation from Representative Lee?
See, I'm not quite so sure at all. I would say I am less optimistic in June of 2021 than I was in June of 2020. The assault on the truth is terrifying. The assault on acknowledging our history of engaging with 1619 and what that means for this nation. The very same people who, you know, some of the people on the Republican side of the aisle who voted for Juneteenth have opposed anti-lynching legislation or are holding it up in the Senate. There isn't meaningful progress on studying and designing reparations for slavery, whether for Tulsa at a most local level or nationally. So I'm getting a little bit concerned that there may be kind of like window dressing. And I think your example about January 6th is a microcosm that if we can't establish basic facts that we've seen before our eyes on television, then how can we grapple with this huge and long and troubled history? I think for me, that's where I'm struggling. And this is coming from the perspective of someone, you know, who studies truth commissions and transitional justice for a living and wants it very much to succeed, but, you know, unsure about the path towards that.
Well, you know what? I want to pick up on that. But first, we have to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about truth commissions today on Radio Times, the role that they play. Does the U.S. need to establish one? And that's Dr. Kile Bohile Zhrebko. She's an assistant professor of government at William & Mary, founder and director of the International Justice Lab. Dr. Charles Chavis is with us as well, assistant professor of conflict resolution and history at George Mason University, commissioner at the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guests about whether it is time for the U.S. to establish a truth commission or a truth and reconciliation commission to confront and acknowledge the country's legacy of racism. But how do we tell the truth or get to the truth when we don't even agree on the facts? Dr. Chavis, let me go back to you. And I hear your optimism. I hear from Dr. Zhrebko that she is not as optimistic as you, that we are in a moment right now where we can address some of these this systemic racism that continues to haunt us. Where does your optimism come from?
It comes from not only my experience as a Maryland commissioner, but also my experience as co-chair for the movement to establish the U.S. Commission. We see it as it is indeed a movement of movements, right? And so the thing is, when we think about what politicians are oftentimes asked to do, you know, in many ways throughout our country, if we left everything up to our politicians to handle, then we we'd be in bad shape.
this is a sad commentary, but yes, I hear you.
It specifically as it relates to, unfortunately, addressing and confronting systemic racism, because that's really what this is all about in many ways. I think it's easy for us to have these symbolic celebrations and, you know, really like for Juneteenth, for example, even when we have testimonies from victims of Tulsa and others where the history is honored. But, you know, there's always that major shift that it, a lot of Republicans and a number of politicians are afraid to make, that indeed these traumas that are, were dealt with in the past have a legacy and continue to manifest in new forms. And that is the biggest task for our Congress in many ways, is the debate over whether or not to acknowledge, deal with, and remedy issues pertaining to systemic racism and the outcomes that are associated with the historical inequalities that continue to this day. And so working with the commission and the movement, I receive emails every day from hundreds of volunteers. We have a number of faith groups, interdenominational, multiracial groups from various sides of the aisle who are all calling on this. In fact, Governor Hogan actually wrote a letter directly to President Biden calling on him to establish this commission. And so we are optimistic, not only because of some outlier Republicans who are supporting this commission, who are not in Congress, who are not up for reelection in many ways. We see the movement being driven by those on the ground who are asking their country to meet them halfway.
Dr. Drebko, let me go to you. And my husband and I went to Germany a number of years ago, and I was frankly surprised, shocked, but heartened to see how it has wrestled with its Nazi history, its Nazi past, tearing down monuments, setting up museums. There's a terror museum that we went to. You know, you can visit Auschwitz and other concentration camps, death camps, and see for yourself what the Nazis did to Jews and to others. Are there lessons that, and I'm sure this was probably not an easy thing for Germany to do, but are there lessons that we can apply to this country that perhaps Germany was able to do? I don't know if they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but this was one of their ways of dealing with the truth.
Thank you for that question. Germany actually had a couple of truth commissions, but they were meant to address East Germany specifically, not the Nazi regime. The primary modality of transitional justice post-Holocaust were the Nuremberg tribunals, and also vetting former bureaucrats, et cetera, members of the government out of civil service, for example. So I do think that there is something to be learned from the German case. I think situating violence and making it part of the built landscape, mm-hmm. as well as the psychic landscape as part of the collective consciousness, is really important. Since you raised the example of, you know, concentration camps, I think here in the South, I'm a California girl, but now live in Virginia. And I think it's so strange that people like have their weddings and parties at plantations, for example, when these were just kind of like slave camps and like death camps. And so I think in the US, we're going to need to reorient so fundamentally our view of history, because I wouldn't get married at Auschwitz, right? So why would someone get married at, you know, a slave plantation? And so I think there's a lot of unlearning, relearning, and learning anew in this country that's so important, beyond, you know, government initiatives, but, you know, but also at a local level.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, we have schools, we have colleges and universities. You both teach at ones, but how do we address the education that obviously goes along with something like a truth commission, Dr. Jacquebot?
Yeah, so at the College of William & Mary, we have this project called the Lemon Project, which I see very much as a campus truth commission. And so the project is tasked with engaging the three-century-long relationship between Black folks in Virginia and the college, because the college, as well as individuals, be it students, faculty, et cetera, did enslave Africans and their descendants when we opened as a school in 1693. And so, you know, we've been uncovering this truth, learning the names of the formerly enslaved, commemorating them. We have a new dorm called Lemon Hall, which is named after one of the persons enslaved by the college. We have a new memorial to the enslaved that is, we just had our groundbreaking ceremony earlier a few weeks ago, which is very encouraging and grappling with the truth of our history as an institution and bringing that right back into the classroom. And so when I started my transitional justice seminar this past spring, you know, beginning with a land acknowledgement, where do we sit, right? On stolen indigenous land, and that, you know, where blood was spilled as part of theft by the English. And then likewise, the people who then labored on that, on this land, who were enslaved on this land. And so I try and always situate the college within the broader area, 1607 at Jamestown, that's 5 miles from campus. 1619 with the arrival of the first enslaved at Point Comfort, now Hampton, Virginia, that's 30 miles from campus. And so what happens here has and always will matter for what happens in the rest of the country. And so using the university, both its physical location and its historical location in the classroom and beyond, has been really important for me and for my colleagues at the Lemon Project and throughout the university.
No, I mean, history is all around us. To you, Dr. Chavis, here's a comment from Michael, who says, if there is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission established, is it going to include Indigenous people?
Oh, I think it has to. I think it has to. I think what I mentioned previously, when we talk about the ways in which our nation was indeed conceived in those injustices and inequalities at the founding, you know, it's not only anti-Blackness and anti-Black racism, but it is racism. And when I use racism, I'm specifically speaking to the oppression of Indigenous people that has continued since the first Europeans have arrived in this country.
I mean, what do we owe then Indigenous people, people who were enslaved, their ancestors? I mean, especially if they are no longer with us, what do we owe these people? I'll put that to you, Dr. Chavis.
Well, I think what's important is having a process, right? Because in many ways, what is owed could really never be given, right? In terms of just in general, I mean, in terms of Native Americans supporting the Native American community, they deserve this entire country. But we have to be realistic as to what the U.S. is prepared to do as a nation to preserve itself. And so I think, but along the way, there is a way that we can begin to come together through a specific process. And that's why I think Dr. Trubko's work on these commissions is so essential, so that we can learn from other examples as to laying out a process where we can move towards a semblance of justice for these communities who have suffered, and their suffering is realized, even though these acts happened in the past, their suffering is realized in these continuing and ongoing outcomes that we continue to see happen specifically to those indigenous populations, but also to African-American communities as well. One of the things that we learned from COVID-19 is something that communities of color and indigenous communities have learned throughout history, that we, in many ways, as an African-American man, we are disproportionately affected by global pandemics, but that is by pandemics and by within the healthcare system. But that just doesn't stop there. You also have the disproportionate effects that can be tracked through history within the education system. We haven't even talked about the loophole within the 13th Amendment that allows us to enslave those who are incarcerated, right? And this would continue, as well as Jim Crow laws, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's kind of where we have to get to. But I think to your earlier point about history, it's so important for us to really begin to salvage the humanity and begin to tell the story, the true story of our nation's history, that is that includes those who have been left out and written off, specifically those of color and minorities who have been written off.
Well, let me turn to you, Dr. Zhrubko, and how does telling the truth, how is that healing? How does that heal a country or a people?
I struggle with the healing and reconciliation part of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, and I'm sure that's funny or surprising from hearing that from someone who studies these. I tend to look at or think of these as just truth commissions that can perhaps create the conditions for healing and for reconciliation. But I think we always have to manage expectations, and I think the truth is valuable. And then, you know, if that means that we have, you know, interracial reconciliation, if that means that there is healing, that there is progress, maybe that's one way to operationalize healing, to think about progress. The truth can provide a foundation for that. But there's this, Marty, and I'm going to use this expression, sure, the trouble with the truth, which is that once you know the truth, you have to act on it. And I think that's why there is an assault on the truth right now that we are experiencing, why there is opposition to viewing history with a critical eye, why there is a resistance to acknowledging that original sin. I mentioned at the top that transitional justice is truth, justice, reparations, and institutional reforms. And that first part is truth. So once we learn and we establish the through line from enslavement of Africans and their descendants to police brutality today and in the middle lynchings, to connect to Dr. Chavez's work and of the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission, then it's clear that we have to repair the harm now that we understand it, now that we know about it. Well, what does that mean? Well, there are symbolic gestures like the establishment of Juneteenth and other types of commemorations, but then there are also material gestures that are needed, whether that is cash payments, whether that is mortgage assistance, whether that is admission to college, whether that is universal health care. We had health care as part of reparations in Sierra Leone, where people had been, you know, amputated as part of the conflict, right? Or counseling and psychological services as part of reparations. And so we can't just know the truth, establish the truth, and be unprepared to act on it. And I think that's where other countries have struggled, even South Africa, which is, you know, one of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's par excellence globally, where people who were promised reparations and who did not receive them, or who testified and went through the trouble of reliving their trauma, when they were not repaired, they viewed much less favorably the commission than at the onset. And so I think it's not, so there we go again, the trouble, sure, of the truth. Once we know it, we have to do something with it. And I think in anticipation of the latter, dealing with it and not wanting to deal with it, rather, people are trying to avoid the question altogether.
And we're talking about truth commissions, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Stu has a comment. Truth cannot eliminate hate. Hate must become unacceptable to everyone at every level, every day. I mean, it's hard, Dr. Chavez, to argue with that, but do truth commissions, can they, what is the word I'm looking for, not eliminate hate, but can they wrestle with hate in a way that diminishes it?
Well, yeah, they have to. And I think one of the reasons why we lean to the framework designed by Dr. Gil Christopher, this truth, racial healing, and transformation model, is specifically that second component, and that is the racial healing. And so once we have this truth that we prioritize, this narrative change that we prioritize, that we then move to this to racial healing, to having conversations and beginning to beginning to really wrestle with the fact that in many ways, all American citizens have more in common than we have different, right? And I think that will allow us to begin the process of unraveling and dismantling the various biases that are all within all of us, specifically as it relates to anti-blackness and anti-blackness. And it, in many ways, the truth, I think, is still essential, because if it's done properly, it can pull on the shared humanity that is oftentimes left out or missing when we see this onslaught and the succession of black bodies and trauma. It's so easy to in the history of our country to dismiss African Americans' humanity, and that is in many ways a learned memory or behavior that is a part of our country. We have to be able to Dr. Shrugwell's point, unlearn these things, not only in terms of this history, but also in our behavior and our thoughts. When we see a black person, when we see an individual such as George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery, why do we only see his blackness? We only see the fact that he committed a crime, potentially of holding counterfeit money, but we ignore his visceral call for his mother. A call that is not reserved for only black people. All people in many ways during that moment were able to recognize his humanity, if not for a brief moment. A number of people in our country were able to notice that brief moment, where at the end of the day, black people in this country, what they really want is to be treated as human.
Well, we have to take a very short break. Let me just read a comment from Victoria before we take that break. She says, as the mother of two black males, I need fewer days off and more work on the cessation of the war on young black men. Every week I remind my sons how to act if stopped by police, complete with a script. Well, let's take that very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about truth commissions. They come through and with various names. There's actually one that's making its way through the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Commission on Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation. That's from Senator Lee from Texas. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with our guests about if the time is right, if the country needs a truth commission to deal with our legacy and history of racism and race in this country. And our guests are Dr. Kile Bohile Zhuagbo, and she's an assistant professor of government at William and Mary, founder and director of the International Justice Lab. Dr. Charles Chavis is assistant professor of conflict resolution and history at George Mason University, also a commissioner on the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and a member of the board of directors of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Zhuagbo, let me read a comment from Matt. He says, it's important we get the facts right when we create narratives that give us meaning. June 19th does not mark the end of slavery in the United States. Slavery did not end in states like Kentucky and Delaware, which had not seceded and therefore weren't covered by Lincoln's proclamation under the 13th Amendment. Until the 13th Amendment was adopted that December. I mean, there is some truth to that. And I guess when we tell the truth about our history, how do we do that, knowing how complicated that can be?
Yeah, no, I think establishing timelines.
The trouble with really, truth, right?
Yeah, the trouble with truth. I think establishing timelines is really helpful. And so people will say, oh, but, you know, 1863 Emancipation Proclamation. It's like, yes, but that was only in states as they were falling under, southern states as they were falling under Union control. As you give the example of Kentucky, it wasn't universally applied until the 13th Amendment. And even within states where it was to apply, the actual notification of enslaved, you know, took 2+ years to reach Galveston Bay, Texas. And so, yeah, that is the trouble of the truth. And a lot of it is just about, you know, releasing information and I think improving history education to go back to a point you raised earlier. And so we should be talking about these things, you know, from primary or elementary school through high school and into college for our population. A lot of other countries that have had truth commissions and other transitional justice projects have quickly integrated the truth that has been learned into educational curricula. And actually, the 1980 U.S. Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians is a great example here, because once the Truth Commission published its report, among its recommendations was dissemination. And so we start learning about Japanese internment in textbooks and in history and social studies classes. There were reparations that followed that commission and other follow-on processes. And so this is where knowing the truth, disseminating the truth, and acting on the truth has proved, you know, really, really successful. And I think whatever processes are happening at a local, state, or federal level should follow this great model that we had, albeit focusing on one population within a narrow band of history, that is the Second World War.
And to you, Dr. Chavis, if we're talking, and you sit on a reconciliation commission, the Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Maryland, as you said, wanting to dignify the victims of lynching. What about the perpetrators? I mean, how do you handle that, knowing that this is more ancient history and there aren't living perpetrators, but how do we deal with that?
Well, we deal with it in a delicate way. We actually are working as a commission. We are establishing a network through the Maryland Lynch and Memorial Project of and the John Mitchell Jr. Program at George Mason, a network of social workers in which we will work with to support the work of the commission, specifically at our hearings. And they will support not only the interviews as well as the work that we'll be doing with the descendants of victims, but also with the descendants of those who participated, whose family members participated in these acts of racial terror. And so we have to really center well-being as well as historical trauma in this work and recognize that these are indeed delicate situations. And in a number of cases, descendants and family members have no idea regarding their family's history. And this is on both sides of the aisle, whether it be the descendants of victims and or individuals who whose family members participated in these lynchings.
Well, let me go back to you, Dr. Drugbo. And if we're talking about truth commissions, are they a form of trial? I mean, are governments on trial?
In a way, I guess you could say, to connect to Dr. Chavis's excellent work and the work of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, I learned in recent years that many lynchings happened in town squares and on the courthouse lawn, not in some backwoods, you know, under cover of night. There were announcements. People came dressed in Sunday best with picnics, etc. And so and law enforcement helped, you know, manage, you know, traffic and those types of things. Right. And was, you know, very aware of the events unfolding in these public spaces, and in some instances, you know, handed over people who were in jail to lynch mobs. And so I think acknowledging the role of the police, so that is a state institution, in assisting, if not participating in lynching violence, and also even the news, newspapers that would and would not report on lynchings. I can't remember the example or the city right now, but there was a local newspaper where a lynching crime occurred, and the readout was, "We will not be recording on the events of this evening." So, which of course was recording the events of that evening, but not really bringing the truth to the fore. And so, you know, kind of tracking what newspapers were around there, were they reporting and were they not reporting on this crime, providing, you know, citizens of a democracy with truth and information or not, and to see, you know, are they still around today? Are they still profiting today? In what ways have they meaningfully invested or in Black communities, tried to provide restitution, et cetera? I mean, the range of actors involved in racial violence in this country, and just to take lynchings as one example, is tremendous. And so in a way, yeah, it is putting them on trial, holding them to account, and, you know, expecting follow through, right? Acting on that truth that's been established.
Here's a question from Melanie. I'll put this to you, Dr. Chavis. How do we acknowledge this new holiday amongst ourselves respectfully? Happy Juneteenth? Is that the correct way of acknowledging this day? She says, in the interest of truth-telling, I think it's important to talk about and to acknowledge. I mean, this is more about sort of, you know, intercourse between people. So how do we acknowledge this holiday?
Well, it's a holiday that should be acknowledged. And to your earlier point about the messiness or trouble with truth, a holiday that really we should acknowledge and celebrate as my grandmother would say, stick-to-itness of African Americans, specifically within this country. And this day, I think, really should be a day where we honor and respect this commitment and this survival to see this day come. And I think it is indeed a unique day, a day of celebration, but it also is a day of suffering as well, that we need, that needs to be solemn and understood as being both and, right? Because it really speaks to the nature of the Black experience in this country, as do a number of holidays, and even months that when we celebrate, including Black History Month. How do we wrestle with the tragedy and the triumph associated with the Black experience in this country? And so I think we need to recognize that Juneteenth, it can be celebrated, and it's going to continue to be celebrated in the manner that communities see fit. And hopefully those are informed by the experiences of people of African descent who are directly connected with these experiences.
Have you celebrated Juneteenth, Dr. Shrugbo?
Yes, my first Juneteenth celebration was, last year. There were lots of virtual events that all of us were able to participate in. But it's fairly new for me. I'm originally from Zimbabwe. And so as I was raised in the U.S. From, you know, elementary school, just learning the history and being kind of stunned by how similar it is to many other countries' experiences and the importance of truth and the consequences of not engaging with truth. But for me, some of these are more recent in my own development in this country.
Here's a comment from Dottie. I'll put this back to you, Dr. Shrugbo, who says, I find myself discouraged at the similarities between the post-Reconstruction state legislatures and the states today that are passing measures to restrict voting rights for minorities. I mean, we're at this really curious and unsettling juncture, Dr. Shrugbo. On the one hand, you know, beginning to acknowledge some of our history and our past, but also trying to prevent progress in the future.
Yes. Going back to an earlier point that we were discussing, that Juneteenth was supposed to or for the formerly enslaved in Texas, was supposed to begin recognition of African Americans' full humanity and full citizenship. And what do we see, 150 plus years later since the first Juneteenth? An assault on full humanity of African Americans and attempts to restrict full citizenship. And so it is really, really troubling. And that, you know, there was this, you know, broad support in the House and the Senate in Washington, D.C. to create this federal holiday. Yet, you know, many of those very same actors are either not supporting the incorporation of more people into the political process or actively trying to curtail access to the ballot. And that has, you know, that's a pattern that's rippling across the country. One more point about sure. Juneteenth. I don't want to see, so it's going to be a federal holiday. For many of us, it's going to mean that we are not going to work. I don't want to see Black people working on Juneteenth. Yet I think, as with many federal holidays, it's going to be people who are, as we've learned over this last year and a half, you know, essential workers who are on the front line, who have to, you know, work for a wage, that will still be working. And so I don't know what the workaround is. Maybe we should be talking about this more, that, you know, on Juneteenth, it shouldn't be, you know, a holiday that's being enjoyed by, you know, middle class and upper class white folks and, you know, middle class and upper class folks from different backgrounds, but, you know, not wage workers of color. That's would be crazy to me.
Well, and no mattress sales either to acknowledge Juneteenth as well. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We only have a couple of minutes, Dr. Chavis, before we have to say goodbye. But let me, we've been talking about what truth and truth commissions can do. But if we don't do, if not a truth commission, at least wrestle with the reality, the truth of this country, what's the price we pay for that?
Well, I think, to be quite honest and just bold with it, we see what the potential price is in January the 6th of this.
The assault on the Capitol.
Yes, the assault on the Capitol. And I think we've got to recognize that in many ways this issue and failing to confront it, it is not only it's a national security threat. I mean, I don't mince words in saying that. And we have to be able to confront not only international terrorism, but domestic terror, specifically white domestic terror that continues to manifest itself in this country. And the more and more we act as if it does not exist and that it is only a group of outliers and is not a specific movement, then we will continue to unfortunately see these events take place. And my hope is that we will confront that legacy and begin to focus on our shared humanity. But while doing that, we have to recognize that there is a systemic issue in our country regarding anti-blackness and white supremacy that continues to be promoted. We have to confront it if we are to have any hope for really healing this country, which Biden has hopes to do.
Well, and we're almost out of time. I'm giving you the last word, Dr. Zhuqbo. Go ahead. About 45 seconds. Sorry about that.
Sure. Thank you. Sure. Just to touch on a point Dr. Chavis brought up is that the first terrorism in this country, domestic terrorism, has been and continues to be anti-Black violence. Lynching crimes were meant to terrorize a community into, you know, not enjoying economic prosperity, political power, etc. And so really grappling with that truth and creating laws and creating systems and infrastructure to deal with domestic terrorism, including and up to January 6th, is essential.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Dr. Kile Bohile, Zhuqbo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And she's an assistant.
You.
Yeah, you're welcome. And she's an assistant professor of government at William & Mary, the founder and director of the International Justice Lab. Dr. Charles Chavis, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. That was me.
And that was you. No, I know that. I know. I appreciate you joining us as well. And again, Assistant Professor of Conflict Resolution and History at George Mason University. He's a commissioner on the Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Kelsey Hansen. For the very last time, my thanks, our thanks to Kelsey for all the hard work that you have done to help us get Radio Times on the air. Thanks, Kelsey. I'm Marty Moscowane.